for the sake of an Eldis feud. We'll have vengeance for him, Calendario broke in, just like we will for all the others. In his cat-slit eyes burned a wild rage. Even though the war to which he referred had been over for 350 years, doubtless he still remembered the name of every elf slain in it. Foe or insult, the Elkian Lakar never forgot, and only rarely forgave. Although Adarin liked to talk of what he called the essential goodness of the folk, they made Nevin profoundly nervous.
"I know you must be eager to meet Jill," Adarin said. "I saw her not a moment ago, but now she's off somewhere. Shall we go look for her?"
Yet Nevin had to postpone the meeting for a little while, because Sliggan came striding up to them. He looked like a baffled bear when the hunting dogs first surround it.
"Now here, Nevin," Sliggan bellowed. "I'm gravely worried. Young Rodri's gone daft, stark out of his mind."
"Indeed, my lord. Let me guess the kind of delusions the lad's suffering from. He swears that Adarin and I are both Dwaelmer, and that Adarin can turn himself into an owl."
"Just that, I..."
Sliggan's mouth slackened as he finally realized that Nevin was being sarcastic.
"Oh, now here, you're not telling me it's the truth, are you?"
"I am."
Sliggan swung his head back and forth, looking at both of them in turn, just as the bear swings his when the dogs close in.
"By the black hairy ass of the Lord of Hell, what have I done? Ridden all this blasted way to rescue a pack of madmen? Even that silver dagger swears it's true."
"That's because it is true," Nevin said. "I suppose I have to do some stupid trick to convince you."
He glanced around and saw a stick of firewood in the grass.
"Here, watch."
When Nevin invoked the wild folk of fire, they rushed to do his bidding and set the stick on fire. Sliggan swore, and he swore again when Nevin had them douse it.
"You can touch it, my lord. It's hot."
Sliggan turned and ran back to the broch without so much as a backward glance. When the two elves burst out laughing, Adarin snapped at them in their own language. Reluctantly, they held their tongues.
"Go get ready to ride," Adarin said. "Get my horse for me too, will you?"
Still grinning, Calendariel and Jennatar hurried off. It was then that Nevin saw Jill, standing at a little distance and watching him as warily as a stag in a forest. Without waiting for Adarin to call to her, she walked over, studying him all the while. In spite of her dirty men's clothing, in spite of her face that was different than Bronwyn's for all its beauty, Nevin recognized her immediately. His first muddled thought was a surprise that she would be so tall.
"Good morrow, Jill. Our Adarin's told me summat about you."
"Has he now? Good things, I hope."
"They were."
Nevin wished that he could simply tell her the truth, use his Dwaelmer to make her remember and pour out his heart to say how glad he was he'd found her again, all forbidden by his Dwaelmer vows. Jill was studying him coolly and curiously.
"But you know," she said, "haven't we met before, on the road or such like, when I was a child?"
"We haven't."
"Then I must be thinking of someone else. Passing strange, I could have sworn I'd met you."
For a moment, Nevin nearly wept. Even after all these years, she still remembered him. After a good bit of argument, the noble lords worked out their next moves in the war. Since they had Dwaelmer men on their side to keep track of Corbin's movements, they could safely fall back to pick up their supply train, then head east, circling round in a feint designed to make Corbin think that they were trying to bypass him in order to take his dun. Corbin would be forced to follow, allowing them to pick the position for the inevitable battle. In the meantime, they could send messengers to any reinforcements coming from Dun Cannobane. Cullen idly wondered how many reinforcements they would get. The number depended on how many of Lavian's vassals held steady for her. After the Council of War broke up, Cullen found Jill by the gates of the Dun. She had gotten both their horses saddled and ready, and was holding their reins while she waited for him.
"I asked Lord Rodri for a boon, and he granted it," Cullen said. "You're going to be taking messages to Dun Cannobane as soon as we join up with the supply train."
"Da! By the hells, I wanted to..."
"Do what? Ride to war with us?
Sometimes I swear you've got naught between your two ears.
I'll wager I could hold my own.
Oh, don't dribble on like a spewing drunkard. So what if you could? I'm not going to let you risk your life in battle when you're the only thing I've got in the world. You know what's wrong with you, my sweet. You're like all young riders. You think that death's only for other men, not for you. Well, I've given more than a few of these cocksure young lads their last drink of water and sat with them while they died. May the gods blast me if I'll risk having to do the same for you.
His bluntness hit home. Jill looked down and began fiddling with the reins in her hand.
I know what's aching your heart, he went on. You think that I don't value your swordcraft. That's not true. You're good enough with the blade. But riding into a battle's a cursed different thing than playing out a mock combat to amuse a lord in his hall.
Well, true enough.
Jill looked up with a faint smile.
Da, do you truly think I'm good with a blade?
I do.
The way she smiled in childlike delight wrung his heart. It was at moments like these that Cullen felt an ugly knowledge pressing at the edge of his mind that maybe he loved his daughter far too well. He grabbed his horse's reins from her.
Don't go getting all puffed up because I said that, he snapped. You've got a stinking lot more to learn.
Leading the horse, he strode away to join Rodri's warband. Although he knew how badly he'd hurt her, he refused to look back. When the army headed south to meet the baggage train, Dregeth the merchant left them. Jill went over to say farewell to him, and he shook her hand vigorously for quite a long time.
My thanks to you, lass, and to your da, too. And here's a bit more than thanks. I know blasted well you two saved my life.
Dregeth slipped her a small pouch, heavy with coin, then trotted off to get his caravan in order. Rather than giving it to her father, Jill kept the pouch. When this hire was over, they'd need the coin, and Dar would only drink half of it away if she let him know that she had it. When Jill fell back into line at the rear of the army, she found herself next to Nevin, who greeted her too courteously for her to be able to just move away from him, as she rather wanted to do at first. All the Dwayomer around her was frightening in itself. That she seemed to understand some of it instinctively was terrifying. Yet, much to her surprise, she found Nevin congenial, with his candid blue eyes and ready smile, dressed like a farmer in a plain shirt and brown brigger, instead of the long robes embroidered with peculiar signs and sigils of her fancies. Since he'd seen even more of the kingdom than she had, they talked of their various travels. As the afternoon wore on, she found herself thinking of him as a long-lost grandfather, whom sheer bad luck had kept her from meeting before.
"Tell me, Summer child," Nevin said at one point. "Your father seems an unusually decent man, the way he cared for you and all. Do you know what drove him to take the silver dagger?"
"I don't, and if I were you, I'd never ask him. But he took me with him because he loved my mam so much. She died when I was just a little lass, you see, and at the time I didn't understand at all. Da just rode in one day and off we went." But I've often thought about it since. Da had an awful lot of coin from a noble lord's ransom. I'll wager he was planning on settling down with us, getting a farm maybe, summat like that. And there he rides in to find her dead. He was more than half mad that day.
So he must have been, the poor lad. Ye gods, that was a cruel jest his weird had on him, and on you and your mam too.
He spoke with a warm, sincere sympathy that took Jill by surprise. Somehow she'd always thought that people like a silver dagger and his bastard would be beneath the notice of a man who'd studied strange magics. And yet Nevin was a herbman, too, who tended the poor folk. He made the Dwayomer seem a human thing, but there was no doubting that it was Dwayomer nonetheless, and for some reason that she couldn't put into words, she was terrified by the very thought. Late in the afternoon, the army met the baggage train, a straggling line of wooden carts, servants and spearmen, just about 3 miles from the seacoast. Since the carts carried ale, the men had a more pleasant camp that night. On the morrow, Cullen woke Jill early.
"You'd best get ready to ride, my sweet," he said. "Lord Rodri's going to want that message on its way."
"Well and good, da, but I still wish you—"
When Cullen raised his hand for a slap, Jill held her tongue.
Have a good ride, he went on, and I'll see you when I do.
Cullen walked away so fast that she knew she wouldn't see him again before she rode. It was better that way. She hated saying farewell to him before a war, because speaking the words made them both aware that it might be the last farewell they ever said. All that morning, as the army made its slow way east, Nevin and Aderyn rode together at the rear behind the carts and the servants. Although Rodri had offered them a place of honour at the head of the line, they had a dangerous sort of rear guard to keep. At any moment they might have to turn their horses out of line and dismount, because not even mighty masters of Dwayoma like they could assume a full trance on horseback without falling headlong into the road. No matter what the bards claim, the Dwayoma has its limits.
I'm truly grateful you've come along, Aderyn said. By rights, this little job should be mine alone. Well, you'll have to fight the last battle without me, sure enough, but I haven't spent years brooding over Rodri like a hen with one egg just to have him killed by a pack of rebels. Here, do you think Lovelane will try to attack you directly? I don't know what to think. That's why I'm so glad you're here.
When Nevin turned in the saddle to look at him, he realized that Aderyn was frightened.
We've never faced each other in combat, Aderyn went on. For all I know, he's stronger than me, and I've never tried to kill a man in my life while he's already murdered one. Ah, by the hells, it's not my life I fear for, but my work. It isn't finished yet. I can't afford to waste all that wretched time being reborn and growing up again. You know as well as I do that without human Dwayoma on the border, there'll be open war between man and elf.
So I do. Well, I'm going to do my best to convince your successor that she should take up the Dwayoma.
And is that our Jill's Weird?
I'm not certain, of course, but I'm beginning to think so. First, she'll have to be firmly rooted in the ways of her own kind. That's my task. And then, well, the Lords of Light will give her omens when the time is ripe.
Just so. But that's a long way away, and the Elkian Lakar need me there now.
Well, if the worst comes to worst, I'll ride west. There are others in the kingdom who can do my work in Eldith.
My thanks. You can't know how much that eases my heart.
Good. But you're not dead yet, my friend. If we stay on guard, we'll keep you alive, sure enough.
Near noon, one of the carts shattered a wheel, a common occurrence. Irritably, Rodri announced that the army might as well have its midday rest while the carter made repairs. The men spread out along one of those tiny streams so common in the Eldith Meadowlands, and unsaddled their horses to let them roll, then clustered around the carts to get their rations. Since neither Nevin nor Aderyn ever ate more than 2 spare meals a day, they had time for more important things. They turned their horses over to a servant and walked downstream until the noise and bustle of the army were far behind them.
I want a look at things, Nevin said. I'll admit that it'll gladden my heart if you can scry him out. I haven't done so much flying in years, and my arms ache all day long.
Nevin shuddered. Even though he'd seen Aderyn fly many a time over the past year, there was just something about a shape-changer that creeped a man's flesh, even if that man had other Dwayoma himself.
Then you haven't been scrying him out on the Etheric. I'm quite simply afraid to meet him there until I can test his strength some other way.
That's doubtless wise. Well, I'll see what I can find out for you. I have the feeling the young cub will run like the hells were opening under him if he comes face to face with me.
Nevin lay down on his back in the grass and crossed his arms over his chest. Aderyn stood nearby, ready to keep anyone from disturbing him. Nevin slowed his breathing, then closed his eyes. In his mind he pictured his body of light, a simple man-like form made out of a bluish glow and joined to his solar plexus with a silver cord. He refined the form until it seemed solid, then imagined he was looking out of its eyes and transferred his consciousness over. He heard a sharp click, like a sword striking a shield, and felt his body drop away. He was indeed looking out of the simulacrum's eyes at his sleeping body lying about 10 feet below him. Nearby, Aderyn's aura was a pulsing egg of soft golden light, his body just visible within it.
Rust red with a vegetable aura, the meadowlands spread out under the shimmering blue light of the etheric plane. The stream was a tall veil of elemental force, extending about 50 feet into the air, like a silver waterfall with no river above. Nevin floated up higher, the silver cord paying out behind him, until he was about 100 yards away from his body. Upstream, the army was a fiery glow of intermingled auras, pulsing and swarming as the men walked around, a mix of many colours, but the predominant one was the blood-red of true killers. To Nevin it was an ugly sight, but he'd be looking for another just like it. He went up higher, then flew, gliding over the landscape below in the cold blue light. As he headed north, the wild folk came to join him. Here, on their true plane of existence, they had no bodies at all, but were beautiful, shimmering nexuses of lines of coloured light. At times they refracted out into a pattern like the glimmer of a bright star. At others, they shrank to a core of consciousness. As Nevin's body of light carried his mind along, the wild folk wheeled around him like seagulls around a ship. As much as Nevin loved them, they were also a nuisance. If Lovelane happened to be up on the etheric, he would see this army of lights coming from miles away. When Nevin ordered them away, the wild folk fled. After some time, as much as one can measure time on the etheric anyway, Nevin saw a glowing dome of light in a meadow off to one side of his path. He checked his flight and drifted over. The pale silver dome covered fully an acre, and it was marked at the four cardinal points and the zenith by flaming pentagrams traced in different colours and set around with the sigils of the elements, altogether a showy and pretentious job of setting an astral seal. Under it, doubtless, lay Corbin's army. The dome told Nevin just how afraid of Adarin Lovelane must be, to exert so much energy to build himself a shelter. Nevin drifted up until he hovered over the pentagram that shone with the pale purple of the element of Aethir.
"In the name of kings, allow me to pass by."
Like a hatch cover on a ship, the pentagram lifted.
"So much for Lovelane's mighty magics," Nevin thought. "He might well be daft at that."
Slowly and cautiously, Nevin sank down through the opening. Lovelane might well have felt his entry and come to challenge him, yet he saw nothing but the pulsing, swarming red mass of the army below. He dropped down close enough to begin to sort out the shapes of the overlapped auras of men and horses, but it was impossible to count them. Rodri would have to be content with the information that Corbin's army was much the same size as his own. As he drifted this way and that, Nevin saw a pair of men off by themselves and floated over for a better look. One aura was blood-red, shot with darkness, and it spun unevenly around the body within. A thin rope of gauzy light fastened it to the other, a shifting, pulsating mass of colour that changed as Nevin watched from gold to sickly olive green. Nevin could easily guess that the red aura belonged to Corbin, ensorcelled and bound to Lovelane. Lovelane's aura changed again to mottled brown and gold, then swelled only to contract suddenly.
"Ah, ye gods," Nevin thought. "He's so far gone that it's a miracle he can work Dwayomer at all."
He watched for a few minutes more, but never did he see the black lines of stress in the aura, which would have indicated that Lovelane was working the dark Dwayomer. Nevin shot up through the door in the seal and closed it behind him, then flew back as fast as he could, following the silver cord that inexorably led to his body. He was about halfway along when the wild folk appeared, a frightened crowd, swelling, shining and beating about him. He stopped his flight and tried to understand what they were trying to tell him. Since they had no words, only waves of feeling, all he could sort out was that something had frightened them while he was in the dome. He thanked them for the warning, for warning it seemed to be, then went on his way. At last he saw Adarin's clear golden aura and his own body. A lump of dead-looking matter. He slid down the silver cord till he hovered just above, then relaxed and let his mind follow the pull of the flesh. He heard another sharp click, and then he was looking out of his physical eyes at Adarin standing above him. Nevin absorbed the body of light back into himself, slapped his hand thrice on the ground as a sign that the operation was over, and sat up.
"Did you find him?" Adarin said.
"I did."
Nevin hesitated.
but there was no easy way to break the news.
You're right, my friend. Lovelane is mad. Stark, raving mad.
Adarin wept, sobbing aloud like an elf. Nevin patted him on the shoulder and tried to think of something comforting to say. There wasn't. Lovelane, after all, was Adarin's only son. While he swilled a wooden cup of ale, Lord Corbin watched Lovelane with all the devotion of a well-trained dog. Raven-haired, blue-eyed, Corbin had once been a good-looking man, but now his eyes were puffy and his cheeks mottled with fine red lines. Lovelane hated him, but he was a necessary tool, since he had reasons of his own to want Rhodri Maelwyth dead. The darkness voice had promised Lovelane that if Rhodri died, soon men and elves would kill each other all down the border. Lovelane gloated over the promise like a jewel.
"As soon as the men finish the noon meal," Corbin was saying, "we'll be on our way and after him. They'll be moving slower now that they have their supply train."
Lovelane started to reply, but the darkness swelled out of nowhere and enveloped his mind. It was the first time that it had come unbidden, and Lovelane was terrified.
"Fear not. I'm your friend, and I've come to warn you. Someone has been spying on you. Someone breached your astral seal. Beware. Stay on guard."
The voice and the darkness disappeared so fast that Corbin apparently had noticed nothing.
"Does that plan suit you, Counselor?" he said.
"It does."
Abruptly, Lovelane rose and shoved his hands into his brigger pockets to hide their shaking.
"I know I can always trust you in matters of war."
Without another word, he stalked off, leaving Corbin puzzled behind him, and walked to the edge of the area covered by the astral dome. Yet he was too shaken to check his various seals. For the first time it occurred to him to wonder just who it was who spoke to him in the darkness. Sitting packed in together, standing along the walls, drinking ale and talking in a sea-roar of laughter and jests, 187 men crammed into Dun Canobain's great hall. 50 of them were the fort guard that Sliggan had left behind, but the rest rode for the three lords sitting with Lavian at the honour table, Eddar, Comer, and Gwerin. Lavian had never doubted Eddar's loyalty for a minute, but she'd been pleasantly surprised when the other two had shown up at her gates. The servants bustled around to clear away the food from the noon meal and serve mead all round. Eddar, a blonde beaky man in his 20s, finally said aloud what they'd all been thinking.
"If Kenneth isn't here by now, Your Grace, then he isn't joining the muster, and that goes for Dromic and Kinven too."
"So it does," Lavian said. "Well, Kinven has the smallest warband in the Ran. Let him go over for all I care."
The lords grinned and saluted her with their goblets. Caradoc ran to the table with a young silver dagger in tow.
"Messages, my lady, from Lord Rhodri."
The silver dagger knelt and drew the message out of his shirt. As she took them, Lavian noticed his smooth face and wondered how one so young could have earned the ill-omened dagger.
"Caro, take this lad over to the men and get him some food, then fetch the scribe."
Although Lavian was perfectly capable of reading the message herself, it would have hurt the scribe's feelings. He snappily shook out the rolled parchment and cleared his throat several times as the lords leaned onto the table to listen. Rhodri described in terse detail the battle at the ruined Dun, then ordered the reinforcements to ride northwest to meet him. He was making for a little tributary of the Brog while he tried to circle round Corbin's army. With a clatter of chairs being shoved back and the jingle of swords at their sides, the lords rose to do his bidding. The scribe leaned over to whisper,
"A private note at the end, Your Grace, from Nevin."
Lavian snatched the parchment.
"My dear lover," the note ran, "although the situation is grave, I have cause for hope. Our Dweoma enemy is so daft that it's a marvel he presents any threat at all. Adarin and I will keep Rhodri safe, I'll wager. May I beg you for a boon? The silver dagger who wrote this message is not the lad she seems, but a lass, and someone dear to me. Would you give her proper shelter? Your humble servant, Nevin."
"Oh, by the gods!"
Lavian laughed aloud.
"Caro, run and fetch that silver dagger to me. Tell her to bring her meal and finish it here."
"Her, Your Grace?"
"Just that.
I must be going blind or such like. When the silver dagger brought her trencher of bread and meat to the table, Levian could see that, indeed, she was female, and quite pretty at that. She introduced herself as Jill, the daughter of Cullen of Caremore. "Well, isn't this interesting? So you're the daughter of a famous man. Have you known Nevin long, child?"
"Only a few days, Your Grace, but truly I never met a man I like more, for all his dwayoma."
"I felt much the same when first we met. Now, finish your meal. After we see the warbands off, we'll get you a bath and find you a chamber up in the women's quarters." When they came out to the ward, the riders were already bringing their horses into line, and the carters were hitching their teams to the carts. Every lord in the Tyrenrin owed Levian his fully provisioned warband for 40 days a year, and not one day more. Her heart was heavy as she wondered if Corbin would make the war drag on beyond that, just so she would have to pay the lords to serve longer. Sligin, of course, would fight at his own expense for as long as necessary. She doubted the others, even though they gathered around her with every show of respect.
"Until you join up with Rodri, my lords," Levian said, "Eddar will be your Cavredoc."
"My thanks for the honour, Your Grace," Eddar said with a bow. "I'll send a man back with a message as soon as we've found them. Let's hope it's quick."
"Indeed. May the gods ride with you."
Levian and Jill stood in the doorway of the Broch and watched as the army slowly got itself into a line of march and filed out the gates of the Dun.
"If you've been riding with your father, you must have seen this many a time."
"I have, Your Grace. And every time I'm half sick with fear, wondering if I'll see Dar again."
Levian was suddenly struck by what life would be like out on the roads with no family to turn to if her father was slain. It gave her a sick feeling. No matter what had happened to her husband, she herself would always have been safe, an important member of her vast clan. She caught Jill's filthy hand and squeezed it.
"Well, here, child, you've come to a safe place now. For Nevin's sake alone I'd offer you my shelter, but I'd be a poor excuse for a noble-born woman if I couldn't care for the orphan of a man who died in my service. No matter what happens, you'll have a place in my retinue." Jill started shaking, a little tremor of her whole body.
"Your Grace is truly the most generous lord I've ever met. If ever you have need of my sword, then it's at your disposal."
It was such a masculine way of thanking someone that Levian nearly laughed.
"Let's pray things never come to that, but you have my thanks."
"So Corbin's taking our bait," Rodri said.
"He is," Nevin said. "I found the army farther east than I expected. They're angling round to follow you, sure enough."
"Splendid."
Rodri glanced up at the sun, about 3 hours after noon.
"What of the men from Cannobane?"
"They're on the way. Aderyn can tell your messenger exactly where to find them."
"I'll detail a man straight away. My thanks."
After the messenger rode off, Rodri led the army a bit farther east, then decided to make camp and wait for the reinforcements, who, according to Aderyn, were riding fast and letting their provisions follow. Rodri felt profoundly ungrateful, but he thought to himself that all this Dwayoma aid, as useful as it was a cursed unsettling thing to have around you. The rest of the noble-born doubtless agreed. When, just at nightfall, Eddar rode in, he was swearing in amazement at the ease with which the messenger had found the reinforcing army.
"At first I thought it was some trick of Corbin's," Eddar said, "but Comer recognized your man."
"Well, there's summat odd afoot. Oh, come and have summat to eat, and I'll tell you about it."
As the noble-born sat around a campfire together and shared a meal, Rodri had the unpleasant job of convincing still more of his allies that the rumours of Dwayoma were true and twice true. With Sligin on his side, the job was easier, because no one had ever seen Sligin give in to the slightest touch of whimsy or fancy. For a long time they sat in silence, the noble-born as cowed as their men. Rodri wondered why none of them, and he included himself in this, were comforted by the knowledge that they had Dwayoma on their side. Finally, he realized that they all felt insignificant, mere playing stones on a game board of the Dwayoma's choosing. For weeks, Rodri had thought of himself as the focus of the rebellion, and his death as its goal,
Now he'd become only a pebble, set down as one small move in a war between Aderyn and Lovelane. That night, long after the other lords had gone to their tents, Rodri walked down to the banks of the stream. In the light from the stars and the waning moon, he could see quite well, an odd talent that he'd had since childhood, but kept strictly to himself. Out in the meadow surrounding the sleeping camp, guards prowled back and forth on watch. The stream itself ran silver, flecked with foam as it chuckled over the rocks. All day, Rodri had been troubled by a premonition, and now it clung to him with cold arms. Something was going to happen to him, something important and irrevocable, and for a warrior, there was only one thing that something could be. He didn't want to die. It seemed wretchedly unfair that he was going to die, when all his death would mean was that Lovelane had jumped one of Aderyn's stones and taken it off the board. When he heard someone moving behind him, he swirled, his sword half-drawn, but it was only Cullen, stumbling a bit in the darkness.
"I just wondered who was out here, my lord. It's my turn on watch, you see. Is summat wrong?"
"Naught. I was just thinking of Carnowick. Ever play that game, Silver Dagger?"
"Oh, every now and then, my lord. There's not much challenge in it."
"You think so, do you? Well then, when this war's over, we'll have to sit down and play, and you can teach me what you know."
Cullen smiled briefly, as if he were wondering if they'd live to sit down to a board together. Rodri felt the premonition again as a clench of his stomach. Something irrevocable was about to happen, something that had guided his whole life here, to this moment, and to Cullen of Caermor.
"I'd best get back to my post, my lord."
"So you'd better. Here, Cullen, tomorrow on the line of march, you come ride beside me."
"What? Here, that's too big an honour for a dishonoured man like me."
"By the hells, it's not. Have any of the noble-born made me an offer to stick close to me in the fighting? You ride with me and you eat with me too."
It was later that same night that Nevin felt the Dwayoma warning, a cold, clammy prickling down his back that brought him suddenly and completely awake. His first thought was that Corbin might be riding to make a night strike on the camp, and he crossed his arms over his chest and went into a trance in order to do a little scouting. In the body of light, he soared up high over the camp, dimly glowing from the indrawn auras of the sleeping men. Above him, in the dark blue light of night on the etheric, the stars blazed, great silver orbs of pure energy. He could see far, but nothing moved in meadow or woodland except a few deer off on the horizon. If the danger wasn't from Corbin, it might well be from Lovelane. Nevin turned his attention to the etheric and saw, far above him, a tiny shape like an isolated tongue of fire. Nevin knew that Lovelane had been trained to assume an elven-style body of light, a huge silver flame as opposed to a human-shaped form. With a grim little smile, Nevin darted up fast, but the flame shape fled, rushing away through eddying currents of the blue light. Nevin might have caught him, but he saw a more curious prize. Shadowing Lovelane at a long distance was one of the wild folk, a peculiarly bent nexus of dark lines and dim glow. Nevin summoned the light and made a silver net, woven of the malleable etheric substance, then swooped after the creature. In an exhalation of terror, it fled from him, but Nevin called upon his own wild folk, who swarmed round, jostling it, shoving it back, thrusting it finally out of the swarm where he could net it easily. Swelling, flashing, it struggled against the lines of force, but the net held, and he hauled it in like a fish. Now came the trick. With the struggling wild folk firmly in hand, Nevin floated back to his body. He hovered above it, fought the pull of the flesh, stayed fully conscious as he slipped back in. The fight was painful. Rather than merely lapsing back into normal consciousness, he felt the melding in every bone and vein as he took up residence in his body again. Yet, in spite of the pain, he kept the etheric net tight and brought, at last, the captured wild folk back with him. Nevin sat up and found a very peculiar prize indeed struggling in his hands. On the physical plane it was a gnome of sorts, but even more deformed and ugly than usual. Twisted, shrunken shoulders, stubby legs, enormous hands, and a snarling, warty face with tiny eyes and long fangs.
"Someone's shaped you, hasn't he? Someone's worked some strange magic indeed upon you."
Paralyzed with terror, The gnome went limp in his hands. Nevin let his feeling flow out to it, a deep pity, a sympathy, in fact a kind of love for this creature deformed against its will. When he released it, the gnome threw itself against his chest.
"You're safe now. You'll never have to go back to your master again. Was your master Lovelane?"
The gnome looked up and shook its head in a no.
"Indeed, how very interesting. Come with me, little brother. I'm going to summon your king here, on this plane. I think it might be safer all round."
With the gnome riding on his shoulder, Nevin left the sleeping camp and went a good ways away, where he could sit down and work in private. In his mind he built up a flaming pentagram of blue light, then pushed the image out until it seemed to stand in front of him, a glowing star some 6 feet high. The gnome saw it too, and stood transfixed as Nevin slowly chanted the secret names of the king of the element of earth. The space inside the star changed into a silver swirl of pale light, light of the sort that never shone on land or sea, and in that light appeared a figure, vaguely elven, yet glowing so brightly that its form was hard to discern.
"One of my kind has tormented this little brother," Nevin said aloud. "Will you take it into your charge?"
The voice came back only within his mind.
"I will. And my thanks, Master of the Fifth of Us, Master of the Aether."
When the figure held out pale, glowing hands, the gnome ran to it and threw itself into the sanctuary of the king. The silver light disappeared. There was only the blue star, which Nevin methodically banished. He stood up and stamped thrice on the ground to end the working.
"As our Cullen would say," Nevin remarked to the night wind, "oh, horseshit and a pile of it."
Nevin hurried back to camp to wake Aderyn. He knew that only a master of Dark Dwayoma could have deformed the gnome in that particular way. This dark master was in for a shock, too, when his little messenger never returned. The question was, why was the Dark Dwayoma spying on Lovelane? On the morrow, Rodri made sure that Cullen rode next to him, even though Peridir and Dalmian both made nasty remarks about silver daggers. The army set out, angling toward the northeast, and in a mile or two reached the settled farmlands of Eldith. The roads and lanes rambled between fenced fields, farmsteads, pastures, and stretches of open meadow and woods, all jumbled together with no true pattern. Since there was no law that made farmers will all their holdings to only their eldest son, the land got cut up into a patchwork that made any kind of straight travel difficult. At noon they stopped to rest on a strip of unused land between triangular fields of cabbages and turnips. While Cullen and Rodri were sharing a chunk of salt meat to go with their soda bread, Aderyn trotted over, looking grim.
"Corbin's army is turning south, Lord Cavradoc. They've stopped about 3 miles away."
"Well and good. Then they're as sick of this cursed game of Carnoic as I am."
Rodri tossed the chunk of meat to Cullen, then rose, painfully aware that all the lords were looking at him for their orders.
"We're leaving the baggage train under the guard of the spearmen. The rest of us will arm and ride to meet them. If the bastards want a chance at me so cursed badly, then let's give it to them."
They cheered him, and what they saw is his courage, never knowing that Rodri had the simple desire to get dying over with. Unless perhaps Cullen guessed how he felt, because the silver dagger merely looked distracted, as if his thoughts were far away. Thanks to Aderyn's detailed report, Rodri knew exactly where to draw up the army. Corbin was marching his men down the road as straight as he could. It was not the de very way to hedge and maneuver for position once a battle was unavoidable. A mile north, the road crossed a big cow pasture. As the army clattered along, frightened farmers stared at them from the fields or ran away from the roadside. When the marchers reached the pasture, there wasn't a cow in sight. From long experience, the peasantry knew something about the art of war. Rodri drew up his men in a single line, a crescent with the embrace facing the road. He personally rode down the line and disposed the various war bands. For all that Rodri was young, he'd been riding to battle since he was 14, and his father and uncles had trained him ruthlessly for war. When he came to the left flank, he found the two Westfolk there, wearing salvaged mail and carrying short bows that they held crosswise. Their horses had no bridles.
So, Rodri said, you know how to ride in a fight as well as stand and shoot, do you?
Oh, in truth, Calendario said with a grin, these are just hunting bows. I'll be interested to see how they do as weapons of war.
What? Here, if you've never ridden in this kind of a scrap before, there's no dishonor in staying out of it.
There is. Dishonor and twice dishonor. I want vengeance for my slaughtered friend.
Jenatar nodded in agreement, his mouth set.
Then may the gods of your people protect you, and I admire your guts.
Rodri trotted back and took up his position in the center of the line, with Cullen on his left and Cairnrith on his right. By the honor of the thing, Corbin would be at the head of the charging wedge when the attack came, and the two Cavredogian would close with each other while their men turned into a mob all round. Except for the occasional stamp of a horse and a jingle of tack, the waiting line fell silent, each man wrapped in his own thoughts. Now that his weird was coming to meet him, Rodri felt perfectly calm, except that he'd never seen such a beautiful afternoon. Every blade of grass in the meadow seemed preternaturally green, and the sunlight preternaturally golden. Some distant trees looked like green velvet against the sapphire sky. It seemed a pity to leave all that behind for the shadowy other lands. Then, far down the road, he saw a plume of dust. He bent down and drew a javelin from the sheath under his right leg.
Here they come!
All down the line, javelin points winked in the sun as the men took on faith what they couldn't see. One last time, shields were settled, swords loosened in scabbards as the horses danced, feeling the coming battle in their riders' moods. The plume of dust came closer, swelled, like smoke from a fire sweeping down the road. Rodri forgot that he was sure he was going to die. He felt himself smiling, as if his face would split from it. As the battle fit took him over, it seemed that his body had turned as light as air. About 500 yards away, Corbin's army broke from the marching line and swelled around to form a wedge for the charge. Rodri chuckled as he saw the green and tan shields of Corbin's warband take the head. Soon he and the man who had rebelled against his rule would face off in single combat. As for the rest, there were over 300 men out there, a nice fair fight. In anticipation, his own army moved forward a pace or two, but it held its formation. Finally, silver horns rang out among the enemy. Howling out war cries, Corbin's men charged. Closer, closer, with the dust pluming around them, they came, slapping into the crescent. Rodri rose in his stirrups, threw his javelin overhand into the mob, then drew his sword on the follow-through. The line of darts arced up, winking as they fell indiscriminately among Corbin's men, who answered with a straight fling of their own. Rodri bounced one off his shield, then kicked his horse to a gallop and charged straight for the rider in the lead. Screaming war cries, his men surged forward, falling from the flanks to close a circle of death. Rodri began to laugh, the bubbling, choking battle laugh that he could never control on the field. He heard himself howling like a madman as he closed with the lead rider. He ducked under a clumsy swing, slashed in, getting a nick on his enemy's arm, and then realized that he was facing an ordinary rider, not Corbin at all. He threw up his sword in a parry and risked glancing round. No sign of Corbin, and he was trapped. Men were pouring round him, mobbing for him in a tight circle. Rodri desperately swung his horse around and felt a grazing blow bounce off the mail on his back as he charged straight for a young rider. The lad gave ground. He was almost out. More men closed the gap. His laugh rose to a howl as he saw how neatly his honour had trapped him. He'd fallen for a false decoy like a waterfowl.
Rodri!
It was Cullen's voice, close at hand. Rodri swung his horse around just as Cullen cut through the closing circle and fell into place beside him, their horses nose to tail, so they could guard each other's left.
Parry!
Cullen screamed at him.
Forget the kills!
Twisting in the saddle, ducking, parrying with shield and sword both, Rodri followed orders and fought for his life. He felt a blow graze his shoulder, twisted and flung up his shield against another. The wood cracked. A blade flashed in toward his face. He caught it on his sword. For a moment the blades hung locked, then someone else struck him from the back, and Rodri had to pull free. He flung up his shield just in time. It cracked again, splitting down the middle to the boss.
Over his own laughter and the battle cries around him, he heard his men screaming,
"To Rodri! To Rodri!"
Suddenly the man straight ahead of him in the crush tried to pull his horse's head around. The Canavan warband was beginning to fight through. Rodri had no time to take the advantage. He parried a slash from the side with his sword, then twisted in the saddle to take another on his shield. The crack ran together with the first one, and half the shield fell away. Rodri howled like a banshee and went on parrying with half a shield. All at once, the horse to his right screamed with that ghastly half-human sound that horses make only in agony, and reared straight up. As it came down, stumbling, Cairnrith killed its rider from behind. Amir was right behind him, swinging like a fiend, and Rodri's two men were through.
"My lord!" Cullen yelled. "Follow me out!"
Rodri swung his horse around as Cairnrith and Amir fell in behind him, but he refused to follow any man. He spurred his horse up beside Cullen, ducked under a slash, and slashed back at the enemy on his right. The blow missed the fellow's clumsy parry and caught him on the ribs, making him grunt and sway in the saddle. Rodri slashed back from the other side and knocked the dazed rider off his horse to fall under the feet of a comrade's horse beside him. When that horse reared, disrupting the mob on one side, Rodri and his men could begin to move forward, cutting their way out of the mob at the same time as the rest of the Canavan warband tried to cut its way in. It was a slow thing, forcing their horses ahead by sheer will, leaning, slashing, dodging, always striking at the nearest enemy, while Corbin's men tried to parry Cullen and strike for Rodri. The Silver Dagger fought silently, looking utterly bored as he struck and parried with a terrifying ease, as if he were some natural force, a storm wind blowing among this screaming, cursing mob. They were almost out when someone pushed in past Cairnrith in the rear and slashed Rodri's horse hard. With a scream, the gelding reared. Rodri knew it would never come down alive. He slipped his feet from the stirrups and threw the remains of his shield as it fell. He flung himself over his horse's neck and rolled, but with calm clarity he knew that he was doomed. A hoof kicked him in the middle of the back, and for a moment he couldn't breathe. All around him he heard screams and war cries. All he could see were the legs of horses. Grunting in pain, he pulled himself up to a kneel and twisted out of the way just in time to avoid a kick to his head. He heard Cullen screaming at someone to pull back, and only then did he realize that he was under the hooves of his own men's horses. Another kick came his way and grazed his shoulder. All at once, Hans grabbed him and pulled him to his feet. Rodri twisted around and landed against Cullen's shoulder, just as a terrified horse bucked up and nearly fell on the pair of them. Cullen dragged Rodri back just in time and shoved him against the side of his horse.
"Can you mount?"
Cullen yelled. Gasping for breath, Rodri hauled himself into the saddle. Ahead of him he saw his own men cutting hard, driving the enemy back. The horse danced and shuddered, but Rodri got it under control, then kicked his feet free of the stirrups to let Cullen mount behind him. Cullen put one long arm round his waist and took the reins. Over the shouting, a silver horn rang out a retreat. Rodri's first thought was that his side had lost the battle. Then he remembered that this time he was the Cavredoc, and the horn had to be Corbin's. The enemies around them fell back and fled as the battle press broke up.
"Cairnrith!"
Rodri howled.
"Sound the call to stand!"
Cullen's arm tightened slightly around his waist.
"My lord, Cairnrith's dead."
For a moment, Rodri's mind simply refused to understand.
"Rodri!"
Cullen gave him a shake.
"Sound the call!"
Rodri drew the horn from his belt, but he merely held it. Finally, Cullen grabbed it from him and blew the signal to pull back. Rodri wiped a scatter of tears away on the back of his gauntlet. Only then did he realize that he was doubled up with pain.
"Two little inches to the right, and that kick would have broken his spine," Nevin said. "Two lower, and it would have hit his kidneys. Our Cavredoc here has a silver dagger's luck."
Cullen nodded his agreement. Stripped to the waist, Rodri was lying on the tailgate of one of the wagons, Nevin's improvised surgery. A wedge shape of red and purple had already swollen bigger than an apple on his back.
"Well, Herbman, I'm just surprised that his ribs aren't broken."
"So am I."
Rodri turned his head to look at them. Up by his shoulders and down along his arms were more bruises and small cuts, where sword blows had driven his mail through his shirt and into his skin in a blurry pattern of rings. It was odd, Cullen always thought, that while bards sang of warriors slicing each other into shreds, you generally killed a man by beating him to death with your sword.
"I don't need to be fussed over like an old woman," Rodri snapped. "You should be tending the men worse off than me."
"Nonsense. There are 3 Chirurgeons with this army, and a Derren as well, who's as good with his herbs as I am. Besides, the battle was only bloody in the fighting round you, my lord."
Cullen whistled sharply under his breath because he hadn't realized that. Nevin rummaged through the packets of herbs laid ready on the wagon bed, dropped one into a mortar, and added some water from the kettle that hung nearby on a tripod over a small fire.
"I'll make a poultice for that bruise. You won't be able to ride unless we can get the swelling down. What about you, Silver Dagger? Do you need my aid?"
"I don't, my thanks. Those young cubs of Corbin's can't fight worth the fart of a 2-copper pig."
"Cursed modest, aren't you?" Rodri said. "Don't listen to him, Nevin. Without him I'd be dead, and I know it."
Nevin looked up sharply and stared into Cullen's eyes. Cullen felt as if the stare was searing his soul like hot iron, making him remember some old guilt or shame, a memory that faded as soon as he tried to capture it.
"Then it's a fine thing you've done today, Cullen of Caermore," Nevin said softly. "We'll see if Rodri can repay the debt he owes you."
"I don't want payment," Cullen snarled. "I know I'm not but a Silver Dagger, but I didn't ride into that mob for coin."
"That's not what I meant at all."
With a toss of his head, Cullen strode away. Whether the old man was Dwayomer or not, he'd not let him mock. The army was settling in around the baggage train. Cullen was heading toward his horse to rub it down when Lord Sliggan caught up with him. His lordship's mail was spattered with some other man's blood, and his moustache was limp with sweat.
"I saw you pull Rodri out of that stampede. My thanks, Silver Dagger."
"None needed, my lord. I promised him I'd guard him."
"Many an honor-sworn rider forgets his oath when it comes to dismounting in the middle of a mob. By the asses of the gods, man, you've got a great sight more honor than that piss-poor Corbin."
Sliggan's voice rose to a bellow.
"You saw what happened, the coward. A base-born bastard's trick, decoying Rodri out there like that. The dishonor of the thing. Thank every god that you saw what was happening in time."
"Not exactly, my lord. I was expecting someone like that."
Sliggan's mouth went slack in disbelief.
"A lord who'd slaughter a merchant caravan to trap an enemy is a lord without honor," Cullen said. "So when Rodri charged, I was right behind him."
When, at the dinner hour, the lords met for a council of war, Cullen was invited by Peridir himself to join them. Although by then Rodri could walk and sit up, albeit with difficulty, Cullen knew that he'd be as stiff as a sword on the morrow. Both Cullen and Rodri listened with rising fury as the other lords described the battle. None of them had been mobbed or even seriously threatened. They'd merely been blocked from riding to help Rodri.
"What gripes my very soul," Rodri said, "is the way I never even saw Corbin on the field, the little coward."
"Wasn't cowardice," Peridir said. "He doesn't want to be the man who personally kills the Gwerbred's brother and the Tyrin's son. This way, if time came to sue for peace, he could blame your death on the fortunes of war."
"And that's what he's after, curse him and his balls both," Sliggan broke in. "He'll hammer at us until someone kills the Cavradoc, and then he'll place his suit."
"If I may speak, my lords," Cullen said, "then there's only one thing to do. Kill Corbin before he has a chance to sue for anything."
"Blasted right," Sliggan snarled. "When you see a dog foaming at the mouth, you don't call the stinking kennel man. You cut its head off."
They drew close together to lay their plan. In the next battle, the lords would ride as a unit, with Rodri safely in the middle and Cullen and Sliggan at the head. Their best men would be round them to hold off the enemy while they crossed the field and found Corbin.
"And I'll wager we'll find him at the rear," Eddar said. "I'm going to tell my men to fight for blood when it comes to facing Corbin's allies. No more of this dancing all around us while they parry. It's time they saw what kind of a man they've allied themselves with."
Sliggan stood up with a grim little laugh.
"I'm going to talk to my captain. I suggest the rest of you do the same."
When the lords dispersed, Rodri kept Cullen at his side and had his manservant bring both of them mead in wooden cups. For a while, Rodri stayed silent, downing the mead in big gulps as he stared at the fire.
"Lord Cavredoc," Cullen said at length, "it's no dishonor to have a bodyguard when someone's trying to murder you." It's not that that aches my heart."
Rodri paused for another gulp of mead. "I was thinking of Cairnrith. Amir told me that Kenno ordered him forward and took the rear by himself. He knew what that meant."
"So he did. He pledged to die for you, and he kept his word."
"But by the hells!" Rodri turned to him, and there were tears glistening in the lad's eyes. "Don't you see that's the worst of it? Here, I've never ridden at the head of a warband before. Oh, I've always been Lord Rodri, but no more than my father's captain or Rhys's extra man. In all the battles I ever rode, no one was dying for my wretched sake. I expected to die some day for someone else's."
"I've never met another noble-born man who troubled his heart about such things."
"Then curse them all. By the hells, why did my uncle have to go and get himself killed? I don't want his domain."
"I've no doubt his lordship will feel a good bit differently about that in the morning."
"Oh, no doubt," Rodri said moodily into his cup. "I'd be cursed and twice cursed before I'd let Rhys have it anyway."
"Here, I've got no right to be asking you this, but is your brother as bad a man as all that?"
"Not in the least, about anything but me. Oh, he's just generous and brave, everything a stinking noble-born man is supposed to be, except when it comes to the matter of my affairs. Curse it if I know why he's always hated me so much."
Cullen heard as much hurt as anger in the lad's voice.
"Well, my lord, my elder brother was much the same to me. He'd give me a good cuff whenever he could get away with it, and it didn't sweeten his temper to have Mam take my side all the time."
"By the hells." Rodri looked up with an oddly embarrassed smile. "Of course you had a clan, didn't you? Here I've been thinking of you as somewhat like the wind and the rain, always there, wandering the kingdom."
"Nothing of the sort."
Cullen had a cautious sip of mead.
"My father was a shipwright down in Caermore, and a drunken bastard he was too. I had to dodge him as much as I dodged my brother's fists, truly. And when he finally did us all a favour and drank himself to death, the priests of Bell got my mother a place in the Gwerbret's kitchen. I grew up in the dun."
"And is that where you learned to fight?"
"It is. The captain of the warband took pity on the greasy scullery lad who was always playing with sticks and calling them swords."
Cullen washed away his rising feeling of shame with the mead.
"He was a good man, and then I had to break his faith in me."
Rodri was listening with a fascinated curiosity. Cullen set the empty cup down and rose.
"It's late, Lord Cavredoc. If I may speak so freely, we'd best get ourselves to bed."
He walked away before Rodri could call him back. Even for a De Verry man, Lord Nowick was tall, 6.5 feet of solid muscle and broad bones. That night he was an angry man too, standing with his arms crossed over his chest and glowering as Corbin and the rest of the allies laid their plan. Lovelane kept a careful eye on him. Finally, the lord stepped forward with an oath that was almost a growl.
"I don't like this," Nowick snarled. "I'm sick to my heart of all this stinking dishonour. That ruse this morning is enough."
All the others turned to look at him with a flash of guilt in their eyes.
"Do we fight like men, or do we fight like filthy rabble? Oh, now here."
Lord Kenneth stepped forward, a paunchy man with a thick grey moustache.
"Which is more dishonourable, to use the wits the gods gave us, or to kill noble-born men when we don't even have a feud going with them?"
"True spoken," Corbin put in. "Our quarrel's with Rodri and no one else."
"Pig's balls," Nowick spat out. "You're afraid of the Gwerbret intervening and naught else. I don't like it, I tell you, sneaking around like a pack of stray dogs creeping up on a townsman's slop heap."
The younger lords were wavering, stung by Nowick's words, and Corbin and Kenneth were unable to look him in the face. Lovelane sent out a line of force from his aura and used it to slap Nowick's aura, just as a child uses a whip to spin a top. The lord staggered slightly, and his eyes turned glazed.
"But my lord,"
Lovelane said in a soothing sort of voice.
If we drag out the war, we could kill Sliggan or Peridir by mistake.
That would be a grievous thing.
So it would.
His anger quite gone, Noek spoke slowly.
I agree, Counselor. The plan's a good one.
Then no one has any objections?
Corbin got in quickly.
Splendid. Go give your captains their orders.
As the Council of War broke up, Lovelane slipped away before Corbin